This is Dave Hammack, and I'm at the Valdez City Council Chambers, and we're anticipating the start of an Exxon morning briefing. Frank Irasi and Don Cornett are here, as well as Commander Steve McCall, who is the head of the Coast Guard Detachment in Valdez and is the port captain. I see at least one chart being put on the wall showing a more accurate representation of, in fact, a copy has been handed to me back here at the table, of the cross-section of the Exxon Valdez, showing how it's sitting on the rock, showing the damage, and how they anticipate to float the vessel. I'm sure that will be one of the major points that are covered today on the press conference. Again, Commander Steve McCall is here from the Coast Guard. Frank Irasi, President of Exxon Shipping, and Don Cornett, who heads the Exxon office in Anchorage. I'm sure he'll be doing a fair amount of the question answering. This press conference is once again being brought to you from the Valdez City Council Chambers. Earlier in this incident, we were getting reports or press conferences and briefings up at the Valdez Civic Center, a much larger facility, after the incident last Friday staged by Greenpeace. There has been a change in the location. This is a much smaller room. It is open only to members of the press with credentials, and we will and there is much more security, and of course we're right next door, about 6 feet away from the Valdez Police Department police station. This table, our broadcast table, is also being used as a distribution point for paperwork for the press, so I can't even see what's happening at the front of the hall right now. We will be starting again in just a moment with a press briefing from Exxon. This special broadcast is being jointly covered on KCHU Radio and KVAK Radio in Valdez, Alaska, and through the facilities of the Alaska Public Radio Network, Alaskom. We are transmitting this to the broadcast bridge so stations around the state can carry it. Also, we understand that through KVAK's facilities, that ABC Radio News is taking this feed. We're about to begin. First spokesman will be Don Cornett of Exxon in Anchorage. A little bit of a shuffling around as people are getting settled, cameras turned on, and I think everyone is checking to see if everyone has their microphone set and cameras ready. This is the Exxon regular morning briefing, and we hopefully will be getting these at least once a day. In the first few days of the crisis, Exxon was speaking at 11 in the morning and usually about 6 to 7 in the evening. They're also getting a daily Coast Guard updates. As we go into day 11 or 12 of the incident, we're down to shorter and shorter intervals. Some of the papers that have been passed out to us this morning, the Department of Fish and Game, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, has given us an announcement regarding the studies that are being done in Cordova, SESMA studies and impact studies. There is also, we have a copy of the official announcement, a commercial fisheries announcement that closed the anticipated spring commercial herring fishery. That is confirmed. There will be no spring commercial herring fishery. We also have a page out of evidently a contract between Exxon and commercial fishing vessels that have been hired for charter, and one of the clauses pointed out to us in that contract had to do with the contractor avoiding unnecessary publicity and agreeing to make no statement, admission, or representation on behalf of Exxon, and further agreeing that all press releases or contacts would be done with the written approval of Exxon before being released. The whether or not gag orders have been issued has been an ongoing ongoing point of controversy at these press conferences. We may get a statement on it now. Don Cornett is now beginning the conference. Okay. There are some problems with the city's PA system, but we're hoping we can get something going.
Is everybody through talking? My concern primarily is whether the scheduling of the conference, of the press conferences, is meeting your needs, and I would like any feedback on that from you right now. One person has said to me you'd rather do it at 10:30 than 11:00. 10:30?
How about 10:30, because a lot of us are on East Coast deadlines.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, right now there's a discussion going on, waving of hands, voting for what time deadlines should be. The announcement by Don Cornett, evidently that tomorrow the briefing will be at 10:30 instead of 11.
Can we try to do the liftoff? Or the float off. We will make arrangements with the Coast Guard for you to be as close as is safe, and that has not been decided yet, but I would not recommend that you go out and make your own arrangements, because we will make the best arrangements that we can for you. If you have come without warm clothes and you may be exposed out there some, or if you're subject to seasickness, I would suggest that you get some seasickness medicine before you go, and see us if you need a jacket or something. We'll try to accommodate you. And it will be at 1:30 tomorrow afternoon. So I don't know what the departure time will be, but that we will post that as soon as the arrangements are made.
Can that be moved to 10:32?
It will probably need to be moved to 10:30 to get you out there in time. And we will try to make arrangements for snacks and drinks, so that you won't have to worry about that. Okay.
You'll have Sal in just a minute.
Okay. While they're working on the sound, let me tell you who all we have here this morning. We got sound, okay. Of course, we have Mr. Iorossi, who will tell you what has happened since our last press conference and what the plans are for tomorrow. I have passed out to you a diagram of the ship in its current position and the position that we hope it will be in sometime tomorrow. I'm losing names here. We have Commander Steve McCall from the Coast Guard to answer any questions that you have about their business. We have representatives of VECO, the contractor handling the hiring and the work in the field. I'm struggling to remember your name, I'm sorry. Suzanne Stolpe is back with us from the Bird and Mammal Rescue Center. She'll tell you what's been happening over there, give you the numbers as they are now, and answer any questions that you have. Have I missed anybody?
Don, question. How close are you going to get us to the wreck, for the record?
I don't know that right now. You might, I don't know if Commander McCall knows that yet or not, but we will try to give you that information when we have all the arrangements made, but we'll do the very best that we can to get you as close as is safe. One of the things that I would like to ask you, you're all becoming very familiar faces to me, but I don't know who you are, so it would be very helpful to me, but much more helpful to the people, especially in the radio audience, if when you have a question you would say who you are, because they would like to know whether that's a question on the mind of the Wall Street Journal or the Valdez Vanguard. So if you would do that, it would be very helpful to us. I'll start off by giving you a little update, and then we will have Suzanne and then Mr. Iorossi. Lightering operations were completed at 8 a.m. today, and work on the Exxon Valdez is focusing on floating the vessel off Bligh Reef during high tide at approximately 1 p.m. Wednesday. Approximately 1 million barrels of oil were removed from the Valdez. Beach cleanup crews are continuing their work with support from several major vessels which are providing supplies and berthing facilities. Activities to lighter the Exxon Valdez were completed this morning by the Exxon Baytown, which had been stripping an oil-water mixture since 7 p.m. Sunday night. Efforts to salvage the Valdez have now commenced. This requires making the ship's cargo holds airtight and then increasing the buoyancy of the vessel through the pumping of compressed air. The first probable attempt to float the Valdez off Bligh Reef will be Wednesday at 1 p.m.
Upon being freed, the ship will be given a complete structural survey and the extent of the emergency repairs will be determined. The salvage chief, a large, fully equipped salvage vessel, is due to arrive this morning to assist in the movement of the damaged vessel. Six tugs will tow the Valdez approximately 30 nautical miles to Outside Bay on Naked Island in Prince William Sound for emergency repairs. When seaworthy, the Exxon Valdez will go to Portland, Oregon, or a Far East destination for permanent repairs. Equipment from all around the U.S. and other countries continues to be shipped to Valdez to expand skimming and booming operations. Currently, 18 large skimmers suitable for heavy oil-water emulsion are deployed. Boom in the water totals 118,000 feet. Another 19,000 feet of environmentally sensitive areas remains one of the most important cleanup priorities. A massive booming and skimming operation continues in Sawmill Bay to protect the San Juan hatchery. Now, there was a rumor going around this morning that the San Juan hatchery was removing their salmon eggs. I got a call from to protect them from the oil. I got a call from Dan Warren of the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Organization, and he says that that rumor is incorrect. It is an option that they have held from the beginning, but it is a last-ditch effort, and he will let me know before they get to that point. At this point, it is not taking place and does not look like it is threatened at this point to that degree. A three-tiered effort of primary, secondary, and deflection boom has been established. Other significant areas include Herring Bay, Snug Harbor on the east side of Night Island, Point Eleanor, and in the northern Night Island area and around surrounding islands. Exxon has also sent boom equipment to Seward to protect areas in Resurrection Bay. I just got off a teleconference with the people in Kodiak, and we're addressing what their concerns are and are sending a representative to Kodiak. I might introduce one other person, Mr. Monty Taylor is here with us. He is a former Exxon employee. As a matter of fact, he used to have the job that I have as the operations manager of Alaska. And he has come back to work with us and will be in charge of going to each of the cities that have concerns, and he will have a group of people working under him and assign them to the various cities, and we will be having constant contact with those people and addressing their concerns and their problems as they become defined. Shore cleanup continues. Well, I missed a sentence. Exxon has also sent boom equipment to Seward to protect areas in Resurrection Bay. Shore cleanup continues, but is still purposely being conducted on a limited basis. State and federal agencies agree that the first priority is to continue to fight the oil before it reaches shore. Crews have been placed on the east side of Naked Island below McPherson Passage. This work will include the preliminary clearing of shore areas, the mopping up of pools of oil, and is intended to provide practical experience to guide later more comprehensive cleanup activities. There has been a lot of discussion about the offer of the Soviet Union to provide a skimmer. I spoke with the governor personally not more than an hour ago. He is dispatching, making the arrangements to dispatch a person from his organization and a person from our organization to the Soviet Union to look at the equipment and to make arrangements for its delivery, and Exxon has agreed to bear the cost of that. Exxon's response team totals approximately 252 persons, of which about 114 are Exxon employees, and the remainder are experts from throughout the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. About 300 additional workers, both union and non-union, are employed in onshore and offshore cleanup. Well over 250 additional people are aboard the 80-plus vessels contracted to Exxon. Further employment will continue as the spill effort progresses. Dispersants were utilized Sunday afternoon south of Montague Island and were thought to be 40 to 50% effective. Further use is being examined. Because of water saturation, further burning is unlikely. The forward edge of the slick has reached the Gulf of Alaska with the major portion west of Knight and south of the Smith Islands. Exxon representatives are ready to receive claims requests in both the Valdez and Cordova offices. A variety of different means is available to meet both short and long-term claim needs. A $10 million fund has been established to provide immediate interest-free assistance to those who are not yet prepared to submit full claims but who require monetary support. In addition, Exxon is prepared to provide partial claims now, claim settlement now to those who have the potential to incur further damage at a later time. Full claims may, of course, be submitted and will be handled promptly. The Valdez Claims Office telephone number is 835-5406, and the Cordova number is 424-4202. A minimum of 10,000 barrels of free oil has been recovered from the surface of the water. Significant additional oil is included in skimmers and bladder tanks. Approximately 18,000 gallons were burned on March the 26th. Okay. Now, in whatever order I said those people would appear, they should now do that.
Good morning. I have an update on the bird and otter counts from the Bird and Mammal Rescue Center. As of this morning at about 9 o'clock, we had 121 birds in the center. Of those, 45 had been cleaned and 15 had expired. That's total for the whole operation since its beginning. There are no new species of birds reported as of yet, and we have yet to release any birds since the five that were released 2 days ago. There's some discussion about possibly releasing them today, but that won't be known until later in the day. On the otter end of things, we have total, from the beginning of the project, received 44 otters. That's an addition of three since last night, or since yesterday afternoon. Of those, all have been cleaned. 21 total have expired. Six sea otters were shipped from Valdez through Anchorage to SeaWorld yesterday. Actually, five actually arrived in SeaWorld and were alive and doing well. One was retained in Anchorage at an animal hospital there and expired overnight. The otter group is expecting Dr. John Blake from Fairbanks, a pathologist, to join the crew either today or tomorrow. He'll be doing some autopsies to take a look at cause of death for the otters. They're also expecting either Wednesday or Thursday toxicologist Michael Fry, who has worked with seabirds and is expected to take a look at how the toxicity of the oil will be affecting both the mammals and the birds. A little bit of an update on the new site. As I'm sure most of you are aware, the otters will be moved from their current site to Groudon Harrison Elementary School. That is projected to happen sometime either late today or early tomorrow morning, depending on the construction crew is working quite hard and has been working 24 hours a day to get it prepared. Once they're in, they will have a capacity for as many as 96 otters compared to the 20 that they have capacity for now. That being 48 fish totes that have been converted into comfortable little otter quarters. There will be no press tours of any of the otter areas today, but as soon as the otters have been moved to their new area and are settled in, sometime I hope tomorrow morning, we'll be able to conduct a press tour of the new area. Dr. Davis and Dr. Terry Williams, a veterinarian who's working with the group, will be available then to answer questions and discuss it. We will be having a press tour today in the bird area, as we did yesterday. It will be at 2 o'clock. Alice Berkner, who is heading that operation there, will be available to answer questions, and she will also be guiding the tour. As we did yesterday, we'll be touring through the bird washing area as well as the bird feeding area. Any questions?
What's the one? I'm Mary Ann Gwynn from the Seattle Times. Sunday night, I heard an environmental specialist from Exxon say that 20 to 30 boats have been dispatched to go out and look for animals. Have those boats started coming back yet?
I know that the birds that we've received in the last 10 days the birds we received last night came from boats that had been dispatched. I don't know the logistics of the rescue operation.
Do you know who we know that?
If you want to come and ask me at the bird center, I'll find out for you.
Paul Living from Time Magazine. Exactly how many species of birds do you have, and can you give us the names of some of the species?
We had 21 species as of yesterday, and my understanding was no new species. We've had common loons, pigeon guillemots, oh boy, this is tough, harlequin ducks. There's been some scoters, various types of scoters. I've seen some shovelers in there. There's quite a number of cormorants in the group. Those are the only ones that come to mind.
Suzanne, Carrie Moran, NBC Mutual Radio Networks. The mortality rate, I understand, may be eventually as high as 60% on these rescued animals. Do you have any update on that?
The reason that the pathologist is coming in is for them to start to be able to explain why the mortality rate is the way it is. As of yet, according to Randy, they just don't want to make any speculations until the pathologist has actually done some research.
Paul, at the Parent of the Cousteau Society, would you continue the cleaning operation if there were no way to reduce the mortality rate?
Absolutely. Any other question? Thanks very much. I'll be available afterwards and at 2 o'clock. And in the center, if you have further questions, I'll be there all day. Thanks.
If I could, before Frank comes up, I'd like for Monty to come over so that the people can kind of see him and recognize him when he shows up in town, if you would permit me that indulgence. This is Monty Taylor. When he shows up in your town, he's the guy representing Exxon, and that you should give him all those calls that you've been giving to me.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Don.
Okay, now, Frank.
Monty Taylor just introduced a familiar sight to Valdezians, or true Alaskans, in Juneau over the years. He's been the Exxon man in Alaska for years, the predecessor to Don Cornett. Now here's Frank Arasi, president of Exxon Shipping.
Welcome to day 12, and I think this, for me, is press conference number 17. The Exxon response team in Valdez now numbers 252 people, of which 114 are Exxon employees, remaining 138 are experts, managers, supervisors, all on contract to Exxon. We've had a total of 60 cargo flights, bringing in over 1,500 tons of equipment. That's 3.2 million pounds of response equipment and material. Those of you who were here from day one recognize that at the time we got here, we were facing three major challenges. We had approximately 240,000 barrels of oil on water. We had a damaged vessel aground on a reef, and the initial indications were that there was a possibility that she could capsize. We also had 1 million barrels of oil in that tanker. At 8 a.m. this morning, we completed cargo transfer operations from the Exxon Valdez. We have transferred a total of 984,000 barrels of that oil out of the Exxon Valdez into three Exxon vessels. As of 9:52 this morning, the last of those vessels, the Exxon Baytown, was clear of the damaged vessel. We now have a total of 998,000 barrels of seawater on board the vessel. Approximately 600,000 is in the damaged tanks. The remaining 400,000 has been put into the intact ballast tanks of the vessel in order to give us the proper trim and stability conditions when we refloat the vessel. Our best estimate at this time is that there is between 15,000 and 25,000 barrels of oil mixed with the 600,000 barrels of seawater in those damaged tanks. This is unrecoverable at the present time. already making preparations for the refloat of the vessel. The conditions, the tidal conditions, will be favorable from Wednesday through Friday. The weather conditions also look favorable, or at least forecast to be favorable. We will start the preparations, the actual pressuring of the tanks Wednesday morning. The very first tide that we would expect to refloat the vessel will be at 13:30 or 1:30 p.m. approximately. I don't have the exact time. That'll be the first opportunity. We clearly are going to do this slowly and carefully. We have no schedule. The folks have been told that if things aren't right on the first tide Wednesday, we've got other tides, so we're not going to rush this to catch a schedule. But sometime between Wednesday afternoon and Friday, we will refloat the vessel. We put out some diagrams just to give you an idea what this refloat is all about. Unfortunately, from this position, I can't do much to the one up on the board. But let me try to explain what's up there, and you could look at those sketches. What we've shown here is, thank you, Don. That's real good. What we're showing is a cross section of the vessel, across the vessel, as if you would cut a salami. It's a poor term, but it gives you a good visual idea. And you're looking forward from aft. This is the starboard side or right side of the vessel. This is the port side or left side of the vessel. This is the main deck. And of course, this is the bottom sitting on the reef line. We've put in two colors. The black is the position of the vessel as she sits on the reef. We intend to apply air pressure in that roughly 30. Just let me step back a bit. The amount of water in the vessel right now is approximately 52 feet. What we will be doing is applying air pressure in the airspace of the damaged tanks above that water, and in effect forcing the bottom 3 feet of seawater out through the bottom of the vessel. That will give us enough buoyancy to lift the vessel, and you see the lines we are showing in red is the position of the vessel as it has been refloated. So the surface of the water where we have this very thin oil layer will drop 3 feet, but at that point we will still have a minimum of 30 feet above the damaged sections. At that point we will tow the vessel to the southwest corner of Naked Island. That's approximately 25 miles. We'll obviously be doing that very carefully. We'll have about 60 people on board. That's not right. We have 60 people on board right now, but we'll be taking a number off, and I don't know exactly how many we'll have on during the refloat. I'll come back to this if you have any other questions. I like to. I know your arms are getting tired. This is day 12 for you too. Let me update you on the oil spill recovery. Don gave you some data. Let me give you some more. Navy type skimmers that arrived a few days ago are proving to be quite effective. These are belt type skimmers, and they're proving to be quite effective for this heavy emulsion. The Navy has 13 more, most of which is on the East Coast, but we have requested all 13 of those. We don't know how many we will get. There are also two of this type in France and one in the UK, and we've asked for those also. We have a large self-propelled skimmer. It is also a belt-type skimmer, and it is currently en route by sea from Seattle. As of last night, we had skimmed, and this is measured in the barges. We have two recovery barges. There was 10,500 barrels in those two barges as of last night. There's a significant additional quantity of oil, and it's almost impossible for us to measure, but it's in the skimmers, in the skimmer tanks, in the transfer vessels, and in a number of bladders that we're using as temporary storage. And right now, I would not hazard a guess as to how much is there. The problem, timing-wise, it appears to everybody, including the Coast Guard observers, that the skimming operation itself is going very, very well. The problem relative to other spills. It's frustratingly slow to everybody watching it, including me. But compared to other skimming operations, it seems to be going very, very well. The problem is getting the oil out of the skimmers into these transfer vessels, which then take it to the two storage barges. The two barges have significant capacity still left to be filled, so it's not a problem with the final storage barges. We have brought a third barge on scene. It came up from Seattle, and it's now in Prince William Sound, and eventually we'll be filling it. The 42-inch boom that Exxon requested through the Coast Guard to the Navy has arrived in Anchorage. It's currently being transported to Valdez. It'll then be put aboard a vessel and moved down to Sawmill Bay. Exxon hired this morning a 165-foot utility offshore service vessel, and we hired that vessel to place this very large boom in position around the San Juan hatchery. By the way, there's 50,000 feet of boom of all sizes and sorts around the sawmill, around Sawmill Bay at the San Juan hatchery. When we get this 42-inch boom there, we will have a total of 66,000 feet. That's over 50% of all the boom we have in Prince William Sound. So we have marshaled an overwhelming amount of our resource around the San Juan hatchery. Okay, I'm open to questions at this point.
Why, can you tell us what the immediate threat is to the hatchery right now?
Well, there's a lot of oil that is coming down, primarily down the east side of Night Island. There also is some oil that moved down the west side of Night Island and then to the south of Night. And the San Juan hatchery is potentially in the path of all that oil. So I believe the hatchery will need to be defended for another 3 or 4 days. Yes, ma'am.
Would you please, Carrie Moran, Mutual NBC Radio Network, would you please explain to us how you're going to pilot the tanker or pull the tanker once it's refloated and above the reef material?
Yes. We've hired a large salvage vessel. It's called the Salvage Chief. It'll be pulling on the bow of the tanker. We'll also have, I believe, four other tugs, which will be working in concert with the Salvage Chief. We don't really expect to pull it off the reef. That's the last thing we want to do. We want to float it up and then be able to move it.
How will you know that it's floating?
We'll feel it on the vessel. They will feel it on the vessel. The first thing that happens is it'll change its heel. Right now it's heel to starboard, about a degree at high tide and 4 degrees in low tide. So if you go out there and the vessel has changed position from the last time you're there, remember that it is moving with the tide. It's getting some buoyancy as the tide comes in. It's settling further down as the tide goes out.
David Burrington, NBC News. If everything went perfectly, how long would it take to float that tanker?
Well, it's 25 miles, and we'll probably be...
To refloat it. From when you start?
I really wouldn't hazard a guess. Maybe 6 or 8 hours. Going to do it very slowly. Yes, sir.
Gary Shepard from ABC News. Getting back to Sawmill Bay, how close is the oil? I am told that it has already gotten in 3 of the 5 concentric boom circles that is defending it.
I was on an overflight yesterday afternoon. The oil is streaming down that Latouche Passage, but the Sawmill Bay is off to the west of the actual passage. There is some oil outside the outer booms. I saw one sheen that was inside the first boom defense. There was a slight sheen, and they were already in the process of skimming that.
Follow-up. If for whatever...
That would be more in place than we're scared to death about.
If for whatever reason the oil gets in there and harms the hatchery, will Exxon reimburse the hatchery for all losses? And what about the fishermen who, you know, in the future would be catching those fish?
Well, the plan that the Fish Association has is that if oil gets, or oil sheen gets inside the last boom defense, that at that point they have 2 hours to move the fish. And we already have a large vessel down there with tanks that they will be able to move the fish from their position below the surface into the tanks, then into a vessel, and that vessel will move the fish to one of the northern hatcheries, northern side of Prince William Sound. It's not endangered.
What about the reimbursement?
Well, obviously that will certainly be something we would face and fall within our division, our definition of reasonable claims, I would think.
So no matter what, you're planning to save the salmon catch, the 2 million fry that are there now. You can save them regardless of hydrocarbon contamination?
Well, we're not experts in fish cleaning. It's the Fishing Association people that say that, and what they told us was that they are prepared once the oil gets, if it ever gets, within the third boom ring. And it will be, by the way, it will become the fourth boom ring once we get this 42-inch boom out there. But if oil does get inside, that by their estimate, they have 2 hours to transport fish to get them out of their current position into these fish tanks, and then on that vessel that we have down there for them, and then move it to a safe location. So they have a contingency plan.
Steve Reinhardt, Anchorage Daily News. Your crews have allowed a good bit of oil to slip out into the Gulf of Alaska. Can you tell me specifically how you plan to corral and sop up those patches of oil?
Yeah, I would just say we're not allowing anything. We're doing everything we can to prevent it, but there is no way to keep that amount of oil flowing on the current from going out into the Gulf of Alaska. We are setting up contingency plans. The first thing we did was to purchase 10,000 feet of boom for Seward, and we have some people down there to help them to rig it if necessary. We also are overflying that entire area along with NOAA overflights to keep track of where that oil is and where it's going. We are also preparing contingency plans for the Kenai Peninsula. The most important thing to do is to pick out the sensitive areas that need to be defended, the same way we did with the my ancestors are Italian, I keep moving my hands, the same way we did with the four fish hatcheries. So those sensitive areas are being defined for us.
What about actually popping up or collecting that oil that is floating out there?
We have all of the boom and all of the skimmers we have in Prince William Sound. Once it gets out into the Gulf, it's even more difficult to try to carry out a skimming operation.
You have more equipment now to chase that oil?
We have more boom and skimmers coming in all the time, and we have some very big units, the one from Seattle and the Russian unit. Yes, sir.
What is the status of your negotiations or discussions with the folks in Portland regarding taking it to the dry dock there? And secondly, you mentioned a destination in the Far East as an alternative. Can you be more specific about that?
Those are ongoing discussions. The biggest consideration for Portland is the availability of that dry dock. There's only one large dry dock in Portland that can take this vessel, and it is normally continually busy during the summer season. We're going to need a lot of that dry dock time. So one thing that really needs to be discussed with the Port of Portland Authority, which manages the dry dock, is how much time can they really make available to the vessel? And those discussions are going on now. We have also open discussions with ship repair organizations in Korea, Japan, and Singapore. We know Singapore has exactly the same problem as Portland, in that their facilities are very heavily booked. What we really have to do now is find somebody who has the time to take this vessel, because it'll be a fairly lengthy process.
Folks in Portland are somewhat concerned about the possibility of pollution trailing the vessel. Do you have any comment on that?
Before we leave Prince William Sound, there won't be any pollution trailing the vessel.
Mr. Rossi, about the herring season being canceled, it's been said that that could amount to a $12 million industry. Would Exxon be prepared to give that money to the Association of Fishermen and have them divide it up to all those fishermen affected?
Let me remind you about the need to identify yourself. It's helpful.
I'm Taylor with CBS.
Yes, sir. When I was in Cordova a few nights ago, that question came up, and we, at that time, the herring fishery had not been closed, and I invited the people to wait until they saw whether the herring fishery was closed or not. Now we are past that point. The procedure they should use is to visit with the Exxon claims representative in Cordova individually. I think every person's income is personal to them. They'll need to show some records. We're prepared today to start advancing money to those people, because it's our understanding that there will not be a herring fishery.
Sir, I want to
talk. Just one second. This gentleman over here has been trying to ask a question.
Jeff Berliner, UPI.
Yes.
Why are you moving the vessel with 20,000 barrels of oil still in it? Why can't that be recovered? Doesn't that pose the threat of an additional spill? And has the state of Alaska and the Coast Guard signed off on allowing you to move the vessel with that oil in it?
I'll start from the last question. The answer is yes, yes. The oil is unrecoverable because it's an oil-water mixture. Sitting on a layer of, I don't know how many feet it is right now. Does it pose a threat? No, because there will be a minimum of 30 feet of clear seawater under it. So there really is no way for that oil to get out. Now, that doesn't mean that the vessel will not have some oil around it when it moves. There is a large cavity under the vessel. And we believe there is oil in the cap of that cavity. This is on the underside of the vessel. And as we move it, it may uncover some additional oil. We have a contingency plan involving booms, and which will not around the vessel. We can't do that, but it will be downwind of the vessel to trap any of that oil and skimmers. And that plan has been approved by everyone involved.
Yes, Mr. Iorossi, Brian Bland with Associated Press Radio Network. I wanted to get a little bit more clarification on something you did touch on. If you can start, perhaps, if you will, from the moment of flotation to the time when you start down the sound to outside bay. Do you have an idea of about how long that will be? In other words, how long will the vessel be right around the same area before it starts down? And also, will it ever be under its own power, or is it strictly tugs and the salvage vessel?
Last question. We intend to move it with tugs. We will have power available if we think it's necessary, but we doubt it will be necessary. The plan is to move it totally under a tug power. Let me think a little bit about the other questions. Okay, how fast are we going to move it? Well, it's not going to be slow enough for us, and it's not going to be fast enough for the pilot controlling the vessel. So between us, we're going to pick out the right speed. We, our concern is once we get it floating free, we want to make sure that the stability of it and the feeling of it is as we expect it to be. If it's not, we want to reassess. We may want to shift a little water. So we will want to do this as carefully and slowly as we can. We have no interest in hurrying. Of course, now the pilot, who is in charge of the vessel and the movement of the vessel, is obviously worried about the vessel moving around once it's free of the reef, so he's going to want to get it to that safe haven in the outside bay just as fast as we can. So, we're not estimating. We're going to be be moving, discussing, analyzing, and it's all going to be done very carefully. But 25 miles, I imagine it's going to be 5-6 hours.
Before you start for the bay, though, between the, let's say you get flotation and it's a best case scenario, how long between flotation and when you start for the bay?
If it comes off, our first step, once it refloats and we know that it's now floating free, we intend to move it just slightly south of the reef and slightly west. And that may be 15 minutes, and then we want it to sit there for a while until we make sure we understand its condition, and that may be a few more minutes, and then we're going to tell the pilot it's yours, get us over the outside bay.
How would you characterize the quality and condition of the remaining ships in the Exxon tanker fleet? There have been things written that it is one of the older tanker fleets in use.
I would not really agree with that. We maintain our ships in absolutely superb condition. As you know, the Valdez and its sister ship, the Long Beach, are the newest in the fleet. I just think our ships are in superb condition. We spend a lot of money on upkeeping them, and most people who understand the business would agree with that.
Yes, ma'am. I have a question. I heard yesterday that the oil might be moving into the water column. Doris Lopez, Valdez Fisheries. But the oil is beginning to move down into the water column. And I'd also heard a figure of 1.22 parts per million hydrocarbons to damage or kill the fry. What I'm wondering is, though we may not see a sheen on top, is there periodic testing being done to check for the...
Large water sampling program already underway. I understand there are 25 different locations where they are sampling. I don't know the results as far as the water column is concerned. Obviously, in those places around Night Island, those stations around Night Island, if you take a surface sample, you're going to get a pretty high reading. I don't know the results, but tomorrow I'll get the best update I can for you.
Good. It was the sampling program, as I understand it, that resulted in the closing of the herring fishery. There has been an extensive sampling program.
Yeah, that's right. I did get that word that it was as a result of that sampling program that the state decided. Yes, sir, back.
Ken McQueen, Southern Newspapers, Canada. Can you tell me what the insurable value of the ship is, or the construction value, and what your insurance liabilities are on the ship?
We're not insured.
It's $125 million.
The vessel cost $125 million.
What is it worth in today's dollars?
In its present condition? In its present condition, I don't know, it's probably $60-75 million. Yes, ma'am, just here.
Two questions. Paula DiPerna, Cousteau Society. One, when do you expect to maybe get that second boom in place around the hatchery? I don't think I heard you say that.
It's en route by truck to Valdez. I think the Coast Guard has a buoy tender standing by, the Ironwood. And I don't know when it's going to be in this afternoon. Do you know, Steve?
Only approximately late.
I think it's late this afternoon, early evening. It'll be moved down to Sawmill. That's probably about an 8-hour trip. So I would say by tomorrow, by tomorrow they'll be working to position the boom. We have these offshore service vessels standing by, this 165-footer. It's a very heavy boom, and it's going to have to be done carefully.
Okay, second question is, would you care to give us an estimate or a guesstimate of how much the cleanup has cost to date?
We don't have an estimate. There's a lot of different parts to it, and some of the numbers are in the millions, some of them are in the multiple millions, so it's It's going to be a big, big number.
Gary Shepherd from ABC News again. Federal law seems to say that your liability might be limited to $14 million plus the $86 million from the fund that was created for this kind of an event. Is Exxon going on record as saying it will waive that ceiling and bear all reasonable costs associated with this?
I haven't really kept up to date. I'm going to let Don say that.
I used to work in that area a little bit, and it's a very complex area. All you need to know is, as far as the compensation for this spill goes, it is not an issue. Money is not an issue. If we start trying to explain Tovalop and Edia and TAPA and limitation of liability and everything, we'll be here forever. We have not applied for limitation of liability. We are handling this with our own resources, and we have the resources to do it, and that's what you really need to know. This gentleman right here.
Yeah, you said before that the skimming operation is going very well. Do you think you will need more equipment, and how long time you it will last?
I understand as of this morning we have 13 skimmers en route, and that doesn't count those that I mentioned, the additional Navy skimmers that we'll be bringing in. So we're moving more skimmers in. We have to choose the right type of skimmer because of the condition of the oily water emulsion.
Yes. Hi, Charlie McCoy, The Wall Street Journal. On the Soviet vessel, are we now saying that the Soviet vessel is going to come? Because I think a few days ago there was some question about whether it was suitable for this.
Yeah, the first specifications we got when we looked at it, it didn't appear that it was going to be much help. We have now got a much better description of the vessel. And you know, we think it might do quite well. So what we have done is notified the contractor, who's been the primary contact through the State Department, through the agencies, to go ahead and get it over here as fast as he can. The governor has also been notified that that would be our intention.
Where?
So it's north of it's on the west side of on Russia. West side of Russia, north of Japan, Sakhalin.
East side of Russia.
How long would that take?
East side of Russia, that's right.
Any guess on how long that would take to get here?
We were told about 10 to 14 days.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mark Stein, Los Angeles Times. Can you tell me how many of those Navy skimmers are here and how many are en route?
We have five. There was a total of 18 in stockpile between the West Coast and the East Coast. We brought five in. They arrived, I think, yesterday, and are proving to be effective. So we have asked for all of the remaining. I don't know if the Navy's going to do that. There's a sensitivity in moving all this equipment because people feel a little exposed themselves. So we'll see how many they respond. The gentleman back with the hat.
Yeah, Bob King with Alaska Public Radio. Mr. Cornett, yesterday I believe you said that there wasn't a gag order on your employees, but according to one of your contracts, it says, quoting here, all press releases or contacts with the press or other media discussing services performed shall require prior written approval of Exxon before being released. Doesn't that constitute a gag order?
Sounds like it to me. Could I see the contract?
I think it's press releases.
We have with us this morning the contractor on this job, and if his representative would come up, I'd like for him to tell you what we have told him. In the meantime, I'll read this and see if I can understand what.
Paragraph, it's section 8.
Representative of VECO is now on stand.
Bill Allen, the CEO of VECO International, and I can verify that Exxon has not put a gag order on us as one of their contractors. I've told my people that during working hours to make sure we get the job done, you know, that they need to wait till they're off time, and they're off time, it's strictly up to them if they want to talk to you. But there certainly hasn't been a gag order put on
Mr.
VECO.
Mr. Allen, yesterday I was coming up the dock. There were a number of men with VECO hats on carrying large bags. I asked them what's in the bags they were carrying, and they walked by. They didn't even look at me. They just kept walking right past me as if I wasn't even there. I mean, are you telling your people not to talk to the press or anybody about this?
No. Now, we're still in a free country. If somebody doesn't want to talk to you, that's his choice. Okay? Now, this paragraph, as I read it, says contractor agrees to avoid unnecessary publicity and to make no statements, omissions, or representatives on behalf of Exxon or purporting to be on behalf of Exxon.
You took the next sentence.
I'm going to read the rest of it. Let's do it as we go. In our company, we have designated people who speak on behalf of Exxon.
Fine.
Which I'm doing today. But we don't have our employees go out and speak on behalf of Exxon unless they know, you know, they're designated to do that. You have to do that or you get all kinds of stories out. And the next paragraph says, further, all press releases and or contacts with the press, television, radio, or other media discussing the services performed hereunder shall require the prior written approval of Exxon before being released. You've heard me stand up here and say, I don't know how many times, that we have not told the people not to talk to you. So I have not given prior written approval. I have not seen this before. We've been working rather fast, but we have said on radio and television, if the people want to talk to you about themselves, about what they're doing, they're free to do that. They still cannot go and say, I'm speaking on behalf of Exxon. That's what we're trying to control, is what we say to you, because it's difficult enough having it. I have more information on this than anybody outside of Frank, and I have difficulty giving it to you exactly correctly every time. Can you imagine what it'd be like if everybody out on this job spoke for Exxon? That's all we're trying to do. They can do what they want to with their own time and their own story.
Are employees in any way told that they'll lose their jobs if they do speak to the press?
No, absolutely not. This gentleman on the end had a question.
Yeah, I'm Marty Klinkenberg from the Fort Lauderdale News. In terms of the beaches cleanup, who and how will you determine when the beaches are actually clean?
We have a large interagency committee that involves federal agencies, a number of state agencies, Exxon, that is setting priorities for the actual beach cleanup until that group decides that they're ready for us to begin the beach cleanup. We're just going to be working along the fringes. I can't tell you when the beach cleanup will actually start. We've got our first boating barge. It's a 50-man barge. It's in station now at the south side of Night Island, and will be primarily, that barge will be primarily for all of the offshore crews. We got people out there that have been out there 7 to 10 days, and they need to get a good night's sleep and a good meal. So that's what that barge will be doing. We have other berthing barges coming in, at least three more, and they will be for the crews working the shoreline cleanup. We are also starting a training program to educate the cleanup crews on safety and avoiding hazards. So all those things are in process. We've set up a very elaborate communication system for the whole Night Island area, which will allow us to have communication from the helicopters, which will be guiding operation to the vessels, to the command vessels, and into Valdez. So all those preparations are ongoing, many of which are completed. That communication system went into effect to its full extent yesterday. It was partially in operation a couple of days ago. So all those preparatory steps are being done. Yes, sir, right here.
Charlie McCoy, Wall Street Journal. I look outside and I notice it's snowing, and it makes me wonder what the forecast is for the next 48 or 72 hours when you're trying to refloat this vessel, and what, if any, problems the weather, what kinds of weather conditions could cause problems?
Well, I know the snow is coming down beautifully straight down, and that tells you there's no wind out there, and that's really the only thing we're worried about. The wind conditions are going to be relatively light, 10 to 15 knots. So from that standpoint, I think it will be ideal for the refloat.
Will the snow cover oil-covered beaches and make it hard for the cleanup crews to work?
I'm sure it's going to melt very quickly. It's not even sticking on the street out there. Yes, sir.
Steve Reinhardt, Anchorage Daily News. The scientists say that
18 or 23 or 24% of this oil will have or has already evaporated. Another percentage is already emulsified, gone into the water column. Another 10 or 20% might flow out into the Gulf where you've indicated it's going to be real hard to catch. So hasn't this delay actually worked? Hasn't the time taken to go after this oil actually worked to your company's advantage?
Since we got here 5:30 or 4:30 Friday a week ago, we've been going pell-mell with everything we have and can mobilize. Before we left Houston at 11 o'clock Houston time on Friday, we had three planes in the air. We've been mobilizing everything we can. I think I told you there have been 60 cargo flights into Alaska. We've got a very, very elaborate logistics system set up to move all of that cargo out of the airport staging areas, onto the road, onto boats to get it down to the site. There hadn't been any delay.
The time taken has made your job easier, has it not?
May I? You have to decide whether you would rather have that oil in Prince William Sound where you can get to it or out in the ocean where you don't really know what's going to happen to it. I think it's safe to say that if we had our choice, we would have preferred it to stay in the Sound because we know that we will eventually get all the oil off the water and off the shoreline. Now we don't know whether it's going to go into Kodiak or it's going to go into Homer or where. So, no, I don't think it has worked to our advantage. The only way it would work to our advantage is if it went to sea and we couldn't find it. Yes, then it would be to our advantage. But if it goes to sea and we find it someplace else, our problems are magnified. So that was not any of the good luck that we've had on the oil going to sea at this point.
The other problem with the time argument you're